All right. We have thus far done the following. We've gone through public hearings. We've had a formal introduction of the bill from the department. We've gone through public hearings. And this week we've dedicated to interacting with various state departments, which in some or other way have a role to play in the furtherance of the objectives of this bill. As we understand it, from our point of view as Parliament, government is trying to prevent an integrated strategy that seeks to respond to the demand side, that is the socio-economic aspect of substance abuse. We understand, however, that there is a regulatory framework that deals with curbing the supply and distribution of substances of abuse. However, we feel that the two aspects are two sides of the same coin. And even though our focus locates primarily on the demand side of the problem, we feel we should make it our business to familiarize ourselves at least of the supply side as well. But not only that, obviously our task is to make law to give effect to particular policy objectives, or rather to give to create a legal instrument in pursuit of particular policy objectives. So it is important for us first to understand what the policy objective is so that we are satisfied that the legislative proposals before us will be able to achieve that objective. One of our reservations thus far with this bill is that whilst it purports to create an integrated and a multidisciplinary response to the challenge, we feel that in the manner in which it is composed, that central objective is very thin. It's very weak in the bill. We believe that the government departments find it easier to work with legislation if it's explicit about what their roles and responsibilities are or should be. And somehow we feel that this bill is not explicit enough with regard to the roles of various departments and with regard to the integration of the different aspects falling within the scope of work of different departments, which are directly relevant to the objects of the bill, which is prevention and treatment of substance abuse. So we want the departments to come and talk to us and tell us about how they understand the bill to be about, what they think the bill means to them, how they see themselves playing a role, if any, in the furtherance of the objects of this bill. And if there's anything in the bill that they think can be added or subtracted that would help enhance their capacity to play their role more effectively in furtherance of the objects of the bill. That's more or less the rationale behind calling the other departments other than the Department of Social Development. I do not know which departments have made themselves available for today, for this morning. And I'll be guided by the committee secretary as to the order that they will present. And maybe before I allow her to do that, let me indicate also that we've received the schedule of legislation that impacts directly or indirectly on the subject matter from the department. I think this afternoon, if there is time, we'll spend that time going through that schedule. I hope somebody who drafted the document will be able to take us through it. But I would urge departments to also allude to the laws that they are administering, other laws other than this bill or the act that this bill is replacing, that they are administering that has relevance to what we're dealing with. All right. On that note, where's Ms. Sample? Has she also disappeared? All right. Honorable Solo, thanks for coming in. Oh, all right. Oh, all right. Excellent. All right. So that's basically how we're going to proceed. We lost a bit of time. We started a bit late. Apologies to those that were punctual and have been waiting for us. But on that note, I leave it to the secretary to tell us who is going to speak to us first. Over to you, secretary.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Zola Weiss. I'm the committee secretary. The departments that confirmed that they're going to come and present today are the South African Revenue Services, Department of Correctional Services, Department of Sports and Recreation, and the Department of Home Affairs. But the Department of Sports and Recreation and Home Affairs said they're going to be a bit late because of the flights at O.R. Tambo Airport. Apparently, there's a problem with flights at that airport. Are they still coming? So in the house now, we've got Correctional Services and SARS. And SARS will be the first to present. Thank you. And tomorrow, the departments that have confirmed are Department of Education, South African Police Services, Department of Justice, Department of Provincial and Local Government, and yes, those are the departments, and the National Youth Commission. Thank you.
I thought we were going to see Trade and Industry. Is it coming tomorrow? All right. All right. So who's starting? All right. SARS, yes, Honorable Sola.
All departments that are supposed to come and present here have been called. I could not remember the Department of Health mentioned whether it's coming today or tomorrow.
Yeah. I understand from the secretary that they're coming tomorrow. Yeah. All right. Okay. SARS is here not to make an announcement as to when our tax forms are due, but to tell us about how they go about dealing with the proliferation of substances of abuse. Over to you, sir. You can just introduce yourself and go ahead.
Jay, good morning. My name is Fanny Versfeld. I am from SAR's head office in mainly the customs environment. And I have to apologize for two of my colleagues who are delayed on their way from the airport into Cape Town. And we have Cindy August also here from our parliamentary office. We're just getting our presentation on the screen. Okay. I believe you all have received a copy of the slide presentation. In introduction, Chair, perhaps, you know, SARS being tax collectors should not talk about treatment and prevention of substance abuse because, you know, those are some of the things that are very highly taxed, which makes it also a product sought after to smuggle with. The tax incidence on tobacco products is 52% of retail value, and when we talk about alcoholic products, the excise duty on 1 liter of absolute alcohol is 62 rand a liter, or an average of about 28 rand per bottle of 750 milliliters. So tax evasion is quite a lucrative business also, and it may lead to substance abuse amongst others. However, in our presentation today, we would like to address the issue of the SARS illicit economy strategy. We'll be dealing with an integrated SARS strategy covering the enforcement division, customs operations, and the customs border control unit. We will also then talk to the SARS legal and policy input, which speaks directly to the bill under discussion. The purpose then of our submission today is to inform the Portfolio Committee on Social Development of the SARS strategy in combating substance abuse, and to comment on the legal and policy implications in support of the bill. When we talk about SARS is tasked to implement and administer tax and customs legislation. Amongst the tax legislation, we also include the excise tax product. The aim of SARS's activities are to provision revenue to government. Otherwise, other departments won't be in a position to do their work, to protect the national economy vis-a-vis various industry type of regimes, or to protect manufacturing and support exports. Mandate, we have a mandate to address the tax gap vis-a-vis the illicit economy. And then lastly, but not the least, also to protect society from harmful substances and or goods. Now, that's a wide variety that we can cover there. We have within our strategy an enforcement and operations combination of our resources, where we have the ICE committee. Firstly, the ICE is the intelligence, customs, and enforcement committee, and then also the illegal economy working group, and we'll get to those issues further down the presentation. But the whole issue of illegal goods, illicit goods, goods that need to be prohibited and or restricted, amplifies the need for interdepartmental cooperation, not just within SARS, but also in general across government itself. The successes that we've had in the past year, 2007 or 8, regarding alcohol, tobacco, and drugs products, need to be mentioned up front, where we had 169 seizures of alcohol, illicit alcohol products. The value of it runs to about 5 million rand. We've also had 2,846 tobacco seizures, and that amounts to some 250 million rand. Regarding drugs, there were 337 drug seizures, consisting of heroin, cocaine, cannabis, mandrax, ecstasy, other drugs, and also medicaments like steroids, controlled substances, and so on, of 1,083. So it tells us that there's quite an active market for these products outside. Now, the approach that SARS has is that we engage both from operational point of view as well as from an enforcement point of view. The enforcement division, the enforcement division aims to determine the nature and extent of the threat. We have created several business intelligence unit desks who analyze the risks, and there we have it as a second point. Compliance risk revision supports the analytical products, risk profiles, targeting, etc., where we can do profiling of our clients, their activities, look at the threat that they pose, both from substance abuse as well as from revenue point of view. Substance abuse, not per se the abuse of the substances, but they deal in these substances. That's the trade, the business that they are operating in. Then we have focused enforcement campaigns, which includes drugs, tobacco products, alcohol products, dual-use products. Many chemicals that get imported can be used for the manufacture of drugs. It's not prohibited, it's not restricted, but it could be used for illicit purposes. Then also to identify and research the value chains and drivers. I've mentioned the benefit that they can have by smuggling these things or not paying our very high duties and taxes on these goods. It's goods that sell very quickly. The turnover is within a few hours or minutes or whatever, so it makes it a big incentive for people to engage in. And then also from enforcement, the connection with the international RILO and SEND networks, which are the networks that address anti-smuggling on drugs and all those type of things. The enforcement division comprises of comprises of approximately 200 personnel. They do combine financial and criminal investigation and debt management work. The guys are very well trained, and we do get good success. The mandate that they have is to focus on the illicit or organized crime economy, to look at organized and sophisticated financial schemes in the illicit economy, to handle cases of sensitive nature, combine disciplines across SARS in a single team, where we do joint audits, criminal investigations, etc. The illicit economy work group will support chapters 9 and 10 of the proposed bill through the provision of customs and tax intelligence emanating from the illicit trade in legal and illegal substances. It will also support the bill by fulfilling a liaison function with SARS internal stakeholders, that is the ICE committee that coordinates that, and external stakeholders, cooperation, joint operations with SAPS, the National Prosecuting Authority, Intelligence Agency, FICA, the Defence Force regarding border control, and the South African Reserve Bank, etc. The capacity that resides there is that we have a research dedicated to nature and the extent of the illicit economy in main substance abuse related goods, which are normally high duty value, quick turnover goods. Acting or assisting SARS representative on the Central Drugs Authority body, and acting and or assisting the SARS representative on any provincial local substance abuse forum. The Enforcement Division is also instrumental for the intelligence for development of the mini drug master plan. And our intelligence support is there for annual reports and any other reports that may be required. When we look at what we want to achieve from a SARS point of view, is to have end-to-end supply chain security and solution. And it starts with from where an importer can order, or an exporter may receive an export order, the invoicing, the financial transaction, the actual declaration and movement of goods across a border, whilst the goods are in transport, and when it then enters either South Africa or exits South Africa, in the last instance, the whole stream that we want to cover in that sense. So both our enforcement, intelligence, and operational issues are focused to cover the whole of the supply chain. To do that, we had to have a hard look at how we do our work in terms of securing our borders, protecting society from harmful substances that may enter or exit South Africa. And as a result, the Customs Border Control Unit was established. The photograph you see there on the screen is the very recent passing out parade of the first 131 Customs Border Control agents that have been trained in conjunction of the SANDF and SARS. The reason for that is that there's an increased global interconnectedness in the illegal substance use and movement. There are increased international trade volumes which make it easier for people to put the stuff within the large volumes that move around. And then it is also in line with international best practice and global trade patterns that one looks at trade security. The existence of transnational organized crime networks, the security threats that it involves amongst others, and the fact that SARS has been appointed as the lead agency on border control also affected the establishment of the CBCU. What do we aim to achieve in the CBCU? Firstly, it's to have enhanced international partnerships. It is towards strong regional partnerships within SACU and SADC. It is towards the improvement partnerships with other government agencies, notably those that I've already mentioned. Towards a more intelligent monitoring of international supply chains, so that it's intelligence driven. You can't open up all the millions of consignments that come into South Africa. We have to facilitate trade. So it's important that from our enforcement side, that proper and correct risk assessment, targeting and profiling takes place. It means that you need to understand the different supply chain mechanisms and incentives. Also, that we would like to have a more transparent and predictable regulatory framework. It drives down the cost of trade internationally in general, and people will know what to expect when things go wrong. Also, more towards a more assertive border and trade management, and towards the creation of a paramilitary law enforcement culture within customs to address these threats. The areas of improvement that we've had so far was that the first trainees, as I indicated in the photograph at the passing out parade, they have been deployed at Ortia, that is OR Tango International Airport, in phase one, and at the scanner unit in Durban, where I am pleased to tell you that the guys have been there now for a week since they've been actively deployed, and yesterday there was a success by one of the border control officers who caught a person from Sao Paulo with 64 cocaine bullets in his stomach, and he identified the person by through his training that was developed and certain identification criteria of possible perpetrators. The next phase, which starts in June and will run until January 2009, is our Tama International Airport Phase 2, because the guys are currently only at the one terminal, Lebombo border post with Mozambique, and also Durban Harbour, which means that we are focusing on the three modalities of road, sea and air, and that we are also enhancing our capacity and skill to address all the other relevant border posts in that fashion a bit later. We have also established the dock unit capability. At OR Tambo there are two dock units currently deployed, and the Durban Harbour K9 unit is also being rolled out. These dogs are trained especially with a focus on substance smuggling, i.e. drugs and those things. Also explosives, and then obviously money laundering. They can smell money and CITES goods like abalone and those type of things. SARS have also engaged in the initiative of non-intrusive equipment, where a number of scanners, in total 18 scanners, will eventually be deployed around the country. The first one already in use in Durban. We have had successes already, but not specific to substance abuse for this committee's purpose. Then also to improve the intelligence capability so that you can identify goods before it lands, you can target the correct things, and to support all of this, custom systems modernization process, where we will look at the IT side, how we can support through systems effective customs management and control. From customs operations in itself, we are moving towards full EDI, that's electronic data interchange processing of import-export declarations. It hinges on advanced cargo information that must be received by SARS before the goods land, which will assist us through the enforcement unit to do proper risk management and targeting. The classification of goods in terms of prohibitions and restrictions, Department of Health, for instance, regarding medicaments, other harmful substances, the Department of Agriculture, the DTI, Non-Proliferation Secretariat, they all have certain prohibitions and restrictions on goods that may either freely move or not move at all. And for us to identify it and have systems assist us in doing it, we are coding the tariff items, the description of the goods into our systems, so that when the documentation or information is entered into our systems, it will already trigger a flag to say that these goods are subject to either an import permit or an export permit, which means the goods are controlled, or secondly, that the goods are totally prohibited and we can then seize the goods. We have started with the main chemicals, especially with the impact that it has on the manufacture of illegal drugs and other substances, and we are working hard in getting that sorted out. There's also an initiative that permits are issued electronically, because permits may be falsified, and we engage on a bilateral basis with the relevant department who actually issues these permits for the import and or export or transit of goods. The interface with BIU, Business Intelligence Unit, and the ICRAS is our customs risk assessment system. I've referred to it quite a number of times, is that all these rules for our system and is then incorporated into our management system, which allows for analysis, profiling, measuring of success, does it work, doesn't it work, and so on. Further to that, in terms of trader management and compliance, once goods have entered and been released into consumption, we have a capacity of post-clearance inspection and or audit, which is based on risk and intelligence, and where supply chain and documentary analysis and audit takes place, visits to the importer, visits to the clearing agents, the people in the supply chain line, where we are auditing the process, following the flow of money, and seeing, you know, how upfront and legitimate the business was, and if there wasn't any other contravention. SARS Business Partnerships. SARS have developed a very good working relation with the tobacco industry to curb the illicit market in the tobacco industry. There is a tobacco industry working group and a comprehensive tobacco control strategy has been developed and is in the process of approval and implementation. A similar stakeholder group has been developed with the Old Cape Wine Spirit Industry, or SALBA, South African Liquor Business Association, or Brand Owners Association as we know it, to manage the issue of alcohol abuse, illicit alcohol products, and this has already brought us to the development of a memorandum of understanding where the liquor industry has created their own code of conduct that people assign to, where they are doing self-policing within the industry where they find an illicit product on retailers' shelves. They will put that retailer onto a report to say, if you don't remove those illicit products from your shelves within 24 hours, we'll stop supplying you. So it means that industry in itself is also coming to the plate to stand up and ensure that the business that they engage in is a legitimate business and also responsible business. Further to that, in terms of anti-smuggling, now anti-smuggling capacity that we've had within the customs environment is the predecessor of the customs border control.
Is this done through a private, mutually agreed self-regulatory sort of mechanism, or is it just a voluntary thing that whoever has a relationship, the supplier and the retailer, would then informally arrive at such an agreement? Is it something formal, institutionalized, or casual and happening on an ad hoc basis?
Chair, from operational point of view, the relationship management between the two industries I've referred to is that we are creating a partnership where the industry work towards either self-regulation, secondly towards accreditation, so that if they toe the line, if they are tax compliant, if they assist in fighting the illicit economy, then, you know, we work as a business partnership, because the fact is that any illicit product in the market undercuts the legitimate market, So there is an incentive for the industry itself to participate in that. And I think my colleagues here from enforcement can elaborate on the very specific relationship with regards to enforcement issues in itself. The anti-smuggling that I'm referring to is a customs, current customs capacity which is being phased out as we roll out the customs border control unit. And from there what we do is, if you remember the supply chain that I've shown to you, that they start with manifest targeting, so it's the shipping lines that present us with certain information regarding the goods that are conveyed. From that we can establish according to certain criteria, what we would like to investigate a bit more, examine the goods, and so on. So we do manifest targeting. The visibility of having the people out at airports, at border posts, roadblocks sometimes in conjunction with SAPs, visibility and interdiction of these goods that are being smuggled. Then cargo interventions, the rummaging of vessels, aircraft and vehicles, where we would stop a vehicle, for instance, have them unpack the vehicle, cannabis, for instance, you know, at some of our border posts. This is one of the ways that we intervene on interdicting these goods. Doing surveillance and patrols. We have also engaged on several training exercises with the UNODC, where we've trained up joint SAPS and SARS customs people in drug teams, you know, develop them with skills how to detect, how to prosecute, and follow up on this. Last year, November, was the last course that we've presented, and some 36 people completed that training session. We have also established in Durban and Cape Town joint SAPSARS drugs teams that work on a day-to-day basis together, where they share information, do profiling, targeting, and so on. And then the rest I have referred to when we spoke about the CVCU. The legal and policy division, because obviously everything that we do must be mandated, and that is being done through legal and policy provisions, is that the SARS-administered legislation we talk of here that impacts is the Income Tax Act, the Value Added Tax Act, which are more revenue-orientated, financially-oriented, but then also the Customs and Excise Act, which is the enforcement type of issues that we have here. You will also find within the Income Tax Act and the VAT Act similar provisions for enforcement as you find with the Customs Act. Section 4, Section 113, 2 and 8 in particular.
Can I just indicate to the officials that as various departments point to specific legislative instruments that they administer, that those be added to this schedule, because we're trying to build a schedule of laws that various departments are administering, so that we have a sense, a more comprehensive picture of the overall system and how the different components come together. But thanks for providing that kind of very direct information.
Section 113.2 and 113.8 in particular allows for SARS to act on an agency basis for other government departments, i.e. in terms of prohibitions and restrictions, where let's say the Department of Health will legislate to say you can't have this type of medication without an import permit or an export permit. Once it's gazetted, we take it up into our regulations or operational policy, where we will then give effect to that restriction and or prohibition, and that we then act on an if an agent for that department. The input that we have more specifically with regards to the bill that are being discussed today is general notes in terms of clause 2. SAR supports the objectives of the bill. Clause 3.2e The collaborative approach among government departments and agencies is supported. Clause 7.1 and Clause 9.1. The consultation process referred to is supported. Clause 49.2. SARS will be part of the Central Drug Authority. Clauses 53 and 56. SARS could be part of the Provincial Substance Abuse Forum and the Local Drug Action Committee. Obviously, once these bodies are established, then SARS will engage. And then Clause 58.1, government departments will be required to commit to provide human and financial resources to ensure the implementation of the National Drug and Master Plan, which may have a budgetary impact, and we should take this up with Treasury and so on. Specific comments, Clause 49.2.1, reference to the South African Revenue Service, SIS. Should please read the South African Revenue Service singular. Clause 54.b, the flow of information between members of the forum will be subject to the current legal framework. The provisions of Section 4.3 of the Customs Act do not contemplate the disclosure of taxpayer-specific information in this in the circumstances, and this will also apply to the other SARS-administered legislation when we talk of Income Tax Act and the VAT Act and so on. Clause 58.2, the clause provides that the Central Drug Authority must request the responsible government departments to submit annual reports and other reports as may be required. Again, the provisions of Section 4.3 do not contemplate the disclosure of specific information. The same applies to the other legislation. And then if exchange of information referred to implies taxpayer-specific information, then we will have to have a look at the amendment of Section 4 of our legislation, which are the confidentiality, secrecy around personal taxpayer information that will have to be considered.
Are you proposing to come back to us with a definite position on that, or are you comfortable with the way in which the bill envisages this to happen?
Chair, obviously there will be some form of limitation with regards to the information that SARS can divulge then. So it could be more in general, as I've discussed, you know, so many drug seizures, so many alcohol, so many tobacco, but I cannot disclose the individuals or companies or whatever that are part and parcel of that statistic in that sense. But I think that in many instances, and my colleagues again from enforcement can allude to that.
Thanks, Chair. I think what is implied by the specific clause is that if this sharing of information would warrant SARS to provide specific information of a taxpayer, we have a limitation by law. However, if this is about sharing study documents, sharing trends, and some analysis, best practices, and so forth, which is much more general, I think we are protected by law, we'll be able to do that. Should and when we continue to participate in these various committees, find that there is need for us to disclose certain specific information, then therefore SARS will go back and look at the legislation itself, if it requires us to amend it or find an alternative solution. Given these limitations, or also in terms of providing specific information, there are certain requirements that we got to satisfy. For an example, SARS or the Commission of South African Revenue can release this information, but following a different procedure, like if it's required by the chief statistic officer or by the court of law and so forth. But I don't think that would be applicable if we're serving in committees that we must follow that route. We might have to look at a much more better way of ensuring that we remain compliant to the law and also we serve the purpose of the committees that are established.
Hence my question. he look at this clause, and given the circumstances he has just outlined,
yes,
versus the legislation that you administer, which regulates your ability to disclose or not to disclose or divulge certain information, are you satisfied that this legislation will not impede your ability to be compliant? Because my understanding of how legislation works is that all laws of Parliament are equal unless in the law itself a different arrangement is made, be it that the one law will override the other. That would have to be spelled out in the law. If it is not, then all laws are equal and have to be interpreted in such a way that they complement rather than contradict each other. All right. In the event of a contradiction, and the constitutional experts will have to advise us, the law that was last passed tends to have a stronger influence in determining the interpretation, because the courts assume that Parliament knows the law and is aware of the legislation it has passed previously. So when Parliament says something differently, it intends to change the law. All right. So we don't want a situation where the one would be counter-defeating the other, and it's not a deliberate act on our part. We want to act deliberately. Hence I'm saying, if you want to make specific proposals that we can look at in relation to formulation, you can go ahead and do that. If you want to give it a thought, and either in writing or otherwise, revert back to us, would also be comfortable with that arrangement as well. Because you see, one of the primary objectives of this exercise is to look meticulously at this bill as it stands and ask the question, is it going to assist in forging this integrated response? All right. Is it integrating the system? Is it helping to the system to integrate more effectively? And is it imposing very definite and very clear legislative responsibilities to different departments? I know departments tend to be very minimalist. They try to avoid being tied down to specific obligations as much as possible. Our role is to do the reverse, is to make sure that we tie you down as much as possible if it is necessary, to make it clear to you legally what your obligations are in the advancement of the objects of the law. But you can reflect further, and if you have ready answers, you can provide them. But if you feel you need to scrutinize more and revert back to us in terms of how we can improve the formulation, then that will be comfortable with that. Okay. All right.
Jay, yes. I think the message that SARS has at this point in
time... For example, you wanted to interject as well?
Apologies.
To be rude like me?
Yes, sorry, Chair. I thought me, if you're going to start a discussion, I'm going to butt in too. Yes. It would be interesting to hear what the department means by that particular clause. Are they looking for general information, or do they want the specifics, before SARS has to go off and amend their... just from another tech?
Yeah. I think you're always on the ball. That's why I like you. I may have issues with the DA, but I certainly like it. All right. you mean you'll be demoted? All right. I'm sorry. All right. Does the department want to just comment and tell us what you had in mind there? I see the CDA is not here. Are they have they divorced us so early? I thought we had an enduring marriage that has just evolved. But all right, the department.
Thank you, Chair. As you may see, we are not quite sure what we mean. But, Chair, I think the point here is that my understanding, Chair, is that there will be certain information that you require in terms of the National Drug Master Plan, where you would, department would have committed themselves, or the agencies would have committed themselves to doing certain things. And there will be an agreement that on an annual basis you want to give us an annual report. But the understanding, Chair, regardless of exactly what this is meant, is that all the departments and agencies will be subject, will do whatever they are doing in terms of the legislation that regulates them. So if they have to release certain information, it will be subject to the laws governing such information that they have. We cannot want to override the fact that they may not release confidential information and say they need to do so. But I think it would be sufficient that they would have provided information to the department if they have to leave out certain parts that, in terms of their law, they have to leave it out, then they should be able to do so.
Are we saying so in this bill?
Chair, we are not quite saying it. I think what we could possibly do, we could say subject to the laws regulating the different government departments or agencies.
All right. When we get to the nitty-gritty. Oh, Ms. Keller, yeah.
Chair, I think the important thing is to perhaps recognize the intention of this particular clause, because if you look at what we expect of the different departments in terms of the National Drug Master Plan and in terms of the functions of the CDA, we want them to monitor and to be able to integrate services provided by different departments right down to community level. And I'm just wondering that disclosure and the extent to which it would impact on communities themselves in terms of being able to identify, for instance, people that are problematic within their communities. I'm just putting this across and looking at it from a perspective of people at grassroots level, at the local action drug committee level, at the provincial drug action committee, I mean provincial drug forum level. I don't know, I'm not sure about the extent to which that would hamper the ability of people to be able to know what is happening within their own communities and be able to then be more aware and conscious and be able to, you know, take whatever measures are necessary to, you know, to monitor and to ensure that we don't have these things being perpetuated in the community. So I'm not sure the extent of that a limitation and the impact it would have on the intention that was the intention of the clause itself and the other clause, the clause 54B and clause 58. Notwithstanding what my colleague has said in terms of saying that, you know, we could actually say that subject to applicable legislation. But I don't think it's as easy as all that. Perhaps you need to think of it. I'm not sure what information, what limitations those are, and I had the gentleman very broadly referred to them. But the impact those limitations would then have on service delivery and on monitoring that is happening on the ground and all those kinds, I'm not sure what the impact is going to be, because I think this was the intention of these clauses.
Chairperson.
Yes.
Maybe it is important just to highlight the fact that SARS as a department, we've got many partnerships and many more other committees that we're participating in. And the limitation that we've referred here is not in my own practical experience the past 15 years became an impediment to any success of a similar arrangement that we're trying to build today. However, I think we've just been trying to be honest that there might be certain limitations. We work with the police. We share a lot of information with the police. We have joint operations with the police, National Intelligence Agency, and many more other enforcement agencies. There is sensitive information. In any event, you'll get sensitive information that we may not be able to provide, perhaps in an open forum where the committee is. But, you know, we may be able to provide that information to specific individuals. It depends on the merits of that particular, what you call. So in my own experience, I don't think we should become fussy about these limitations that we're talking about. Number one is that the intention is very good. We will share the information to whatever extent that we think we are comfortable in terms of our law. And should we have these requirements where we're supposed to share specific information, and I'll suggest that we deal with it there. But my own experience, I mean, we run a lot of campaigns and a lot of joint forums and a lot of joint operations with many more other departments, and we're handling the information properly. And to a larger extent, we do share information, but, you know, we're taking cognizance of the limitations that we have.
My name is Johan van Lochrenberg. I'm part of the Revenue Service Group, and my apologies for being late. I just want to add to what's just been said, and I don't want to get stuck on it, because I take the point that you say we can come back to you if there are critical issues. But the seeming intention of this clause, 58, is to enable the proposed authority to fulfill its functions as stated. I think one can draw some inference as to what type of report it would require to do so by looking at those functions. Whether they relate to sort of general information or very specific pertaining to individuals or business entities per se, I think we must remember that we will probably be interested in those entities and individuals that are not compliant with legislation. Now, the secrecy provisions in tax and customs legislation worldwide is there to protect honest people who comply with the law. And so, like in other countries, there are other legal mechanisms whereby one could access information pertaining to non-compliant individuals or businesses, not necessarily contained in the tax or customs legislation, and not necessarily contained in this proposed legislation, which can be considered as an alternative. I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Look, we'll belabor some of these issues when we come to question time. I just thought maybe I could afford you an opportunity to clarify further whilst we're still on that point, because of its significance. The context in which I raised this question is not really to frustrate the capability of law enforcement agencies to be able to effectively discharge the role. On the contrary, is to actually make sure that what we're doing here is not doing exactly that, and that is to impede and maybe to unwittingly, effect adjustments on the current legislative arrangements. I served in the Justice Committee before, and I was party to the drafting of the, or at least to the passing of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and we spent hours agonizing with the issue of which law takes precedence over which when it comes to regulatory environment for disclosure of information. So it is based on that experience that I took the trouble to actually zoom into that. The other compelling reason is that we're concerned about the efficacy of the system established under the current Act. And the question that we're asking is this bill before us going to make any difference in terms of improving
collaboration commitment on the part of our RS department. Because if the CDA is going to come back to us and say, look, nothing has changed, because whenever we try to access information to enable us to achieve our objectives in the legislation, departments tell us that, we can't divulge anything because we are governed by our own legislation, etc., etc. And other departments could have different kinds of excuses, such that eventually you have a CDA that is not only toothless, but, pardon my language, worthless, because it can't really do anything. One accepts that you see, this testing that happens as well, where a particular department will fill, this is my turf, this is my work, we can sit with you guys and chat over coffee, but that's as far as our interaction can go, nothing more. So we're looking at how can we improve a true and genuine partnership across departments through this tool, all right? Because which other tool is there in government to create such a collaborative mechanism or environment? And that's really the challenge. But all right, let me allow you to conclude, and then we can have a proper engagement with your presentation.
Chair, thank you. I can just mention that if it's possible that we can expand on the nature and extent of information that would be required, we would be in a better position to respond. But then also, as my colleague has indicated, that SARS engages on, either on a bilateral basis with a memorandum of understanding, where we say there's a specific regulated methodology how we will engage within committees, within information sharing, within supporting one another in achieving our goals and objectives, mutual goals and objectives. And I think you're quite right, we can address that. But to conclude, Chair, what we are doing within the broad enforcement and customs framework is that SARS is also benchmarking against international standards, international requirements, and the World Customs Organization has a framework of standards which we have to adhere to as a signatory and party to that organization. Now, the objectives and principles of the framework aims to establish standards that provide supply chain security and facilitation at the global level to promote certainty and predictability. What you will find is that we talk of authorized economic operator, where an importer or exporter or business can become accredited, and where it says that they are low risk. We don't have to intervene with the normal transactions of cargo, and from time to time we'll do audits and checks to ensure that they still apply that very high standard of conducting their business. It enables an integrated supply chain management for all modes of transport. It enhances the role and functions and capabilities of customs to meet the challenges and opportunities of the 21st century. Strengthen cooperation between customs administration to improve their capability to detect high-risk consignments. It means that we have an international network where we can talk from customs to customs. There are other mechanisms within the broader tax administration where similar measures apply. And so that a person who is a culprit in another country moves to South Africa, we will know about that and vice versa. It strengthens customs to business cooperation. Again, the reference, as I made, that we endeavor to put together SARS business partnerships where we want them to regulate themselves to assist getting compliance there, and to promote the seamless movement of goods through secure international trade supply chains. The four core elements of the framework is, first, the framework harmonizes advanced electronic cargo information requirements on inbound, outbound, and transit shipments. I've alluded to the fact that customs modernization, customs systems, and so on, technology that need to support this. Second, each country joins the framework commits to employing a consistent risk management approach to address security threats. I've again alluded to the SARS internal cooperation and coordination from enforcement, business intelligence, and so on. Third, the framework requires that the reasonable request of the receiving nation, based upon comparable risk targeting methodology, the sending nation's customs administration will perform outbound inspection of high-risk containers and cargo. We have what we call the Container Security Initiative, which is already engaged upon and implemented between South Africa and the U.S., and very recently between South Africa and Canada. And fourth, the framework defines benefits that customs will provide to business that meet minimal supply chain security standards and best practices. This is the authorized economic operator I've referred to, where we say that if you comply, if you all above board, there will be certain benefits, less intervention in your business from our point of view. The two pillars of the framework is based on the four core elements, and it is customs-to-customs network arrangements, and again, customs-to-business partnerships. I think you would have heard that with even on the tax side, that, you know, SARS don't want people to fill out forms. We will fill in your form for you. Where do we get the information? It's SARS business type of partnerships and re-engineering. The advantages that we have is that it involves a set of standards that are consolidated to guarantee ease of understanding and rapid implementation. And moreover, it draws directly from existing WCO security and facilitation measures and programs developed by member administrations. It means that, you know, across the world, you will find that people apply the same standards. Chair, with that, I conclude the SARS input. Thank you.
Thank you for that elaborate input. I'm going to open up for questions from members. Ms. Sample, is there anybody else who wants to indicate? Can I perhaps, before you proceed, just say that I if I were to divide the your response to, or your responsibilities in this regard, is that the one area is the legitimate side of the business, and then the other side, the illicit side, call it the night and the day side. Now, the experience that we've had as a committee, we've visited a number of treatment centers and interacted with young people around who are battling with a treatment to get out of addiction and so on. And one of the questions we asked is, are you being coerced into drugs? What motivates you to get into drugs? And there are so many reasons we got, but one of the things that we got is that the young people themselves are saying drugs are so freely and readily available on the street, it's not a joke. They say everybody in the community knows who's dealing, all right? And it's an open secret. It's not even a secret anymore. The way they put it, you don't need intelligence to know who are the people who are peddling. It's common knowledge within the community. They say the police know. They say police friends would be seen socializing with drug dealers. You know, it's an open situation. Now you're giving us input that suggests highly sophisticated intelligence networks and so on and so on to track some of these things down. The picture we're getting on the ground is that you don't need all of that. Everybody knows who's dealing. How does it happen that these people continue to run lucrative businesses over sustained periods of time, given the kind of sophisticated capacity that you've just outlined? Let me leave you with that one question for now and then allow the other members to ask the other questions. I'm sure Magumede, at some point you'll raise the issues that you've been raising about the concoctions that go into the informal brewing industries. But yes, Ms. Masampo.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that very interesting submission. There are a few questions I'd like to ask, some of clarity and some on general information. As part of your illicit economy strategy, which was on page 2 of our presentation, one of the aims was the mandate to address the tax gap and the illicit economy. Could you just elaborate on that, exactly what you mean there? Because I have an idea, but I'd just like to be quite clear. And then you talked about your success rates, and you mentioned the sort of street value of the seizures that you'd made for alcohol and tobacco, but you didn't actually give the value of the 337 drug busts you made, I don't think, because I have a feeling that might be pretty high compared to the others, and it would be interesting to know what the comparison was with the alcohol and tobacco. And then in the enforcement division, under capacity, you talked about acting or assisting SARS representative on the Central Drugs Authority, and again, acting, assisting SARS representative on the any provincial or local. Why would that be acting or assisting? I'm just not quite sure why it's not a permanent thing there. What did you have in mind? Sorry, Chair. I think a huge area of concern within this committee and the department is the huge flow of illicit substances and other illicit things that are going to be coming over into the country in 2010 with the World Cup. And I see your customs border control is aiming to sort of get to top gear by 2010. Are you also working towards that, and would you like to give us some more detail on that? And then you spoke about your success rate in the last week of your newly implemented unit, and you said one of your people had been trained to look at certain aspects. How do you keep up to date with the new trends in the type of people who are smuggling? Because, you know, surely as you're training your people to recognize the smugglers are getting wise to what you're looking for and coming up with new things all the time. I don't want you to give me your highest intelligence kind of things, but it would be interesting to know how you do that. Okay, you've already done the thing on clause 54, and we dealt with that quite substantially. That's it. Thanks, Jim.
I just wanted to share a joke. You know, people say lots of things in pubs and so on. They say that what's the position of Mr. Pravin Gordhan? What is he called? The commissioner. They say he usually goes to golf courses, but not to play golf, but to check out the number plates of the Ferraris that are parked there. And on Monday he goes and punches the number plate in the computer and check and find that this person has declared that they earn only 100,000 rand per annum, and there they're driving a Ferrari. and 100,000 is probably not enough to even pay for the insurance, and that's how he catches them out. But please feel free to respond.
Chair, thanks. If we can start at the beginning with your observation about the substances are freely available, I think we need to have two concepts here. The first one is that, yes, certain goods are imported across borders into South Africa. Now, the customs mandate or the SARS mandate is only as long as the goods are under our control that we can act upon these goods. If the goods have gone into consumption for various reasons, obviously alcohol could be a legitimate product, tobacco could be a legitimate product, some medicaments could be a legitimate product. So the only thing that we're really looking at are some of the drug substances that is illegal, and it will be gazetted as being prohibited and or restricted. Now, our interventions that we have there is that we started with scanners. So, as I said, that in Durban Harbour alone, there were in the past year some 1.7 million consignments. Now, you can't open up each and every one of those 1.5 million consignments. Therefore, we have this move and implementation of non-intrusive inspection equipment. We have trained people up. We're going to have to deploy the 18 scanners and so on. We also work very strongly in conjunction with SAPS, Border Police, at ports, with NIA, who gives us information upon which we can act. And you know, the combined effort, I think, if you look at from SAPS' point of view and our point of view, of drug seizures at their ports, for instance, then you know, the success rate is there. However, it may not perhaps be good enough, but the fact is that we're putting resources, well-trained resources, into this area, says that, you know, we're doing something. The second point is that when you manufacture locally a product, the product could be legitimate. All taxes and duties that need to be paid, and compliance with tax legislation in general could have been complied with, but then the goods are still abused out there, so it may be freely available. From the SAPS point of view, the establishment of joint SAPS SARS customs drug units, for instance, the training that was provided by UNODC to us, that all assisted in bridging that specific gap. The second issue of the tax gap, I'll refer that to my colleagues from enforcement, but if I can continue with the third question about the success rate and the value.
You see, the difficulty in your response that I have with your response is that you seem to be confining yourself to the entry point. Now, at the level of retail, that's where you are able to see, just purely on the basis of people's lifestyle, that, you know, there's something wrong that's happening there. All right. I don't know whose responsibility is it to gather intelligence at a community level that identifies the dealers at that level, so that you can then trace the supply chain back to your role at the entry point, so that there is collaboration between those two ends, you know, the outlet end and the inlet point. So somehow your response is not telling me how you collaborate with the guy who is supposed to pick up at the social level, all right, and feeding information to you so that you can track down the supply chain back to, so that those that have missed your scanner, so to speak, at the entry point, you are able to follow them through the intelligence that you're getting from those that are on the ground and are looking at the distribution point. That's really, it's fine to understand your responsibilities, but I'm not so much interested in that. I'm interested in how your role is helping the other role players so that we eventually can have a holistic response. All right? But you can also proceed to answer with the other questions as you respond to that follow-up.
Yes, Jay, I thought that the second part that you referred to is part of the tax gap that my colleague will address, and I think perhaps he must use this opportunity now, because the customs mandate does not allow it to interact at that level there, what you're saying, but from the tax gap position, i.e. you may be earning more than you're saying, or you don't have a job but you have this nice lifestyle, and that type of information.
Perhaps finish answering the other questions, and then let's give him a platform to deal fully with that area.
Okay.
Okay.
The success rate about the values, also the colleagues from the enforcement side can allude to that, but the reason why I didn't mention any number was that I haven't added them up, actually. I've got the information here. But if I just look at it, you know, the way that they sort of calculate the value is based on a certain so-called street value. If we look at the drugs itself, then we talk of 881 million rand. More or less the amount. The other medicaments that I was referring to, steroids, controlled substances and so on, that adds up to 5.9, about 6 million rand. If that satisfies the committee that issue. Then the issue about the CDA, the assistance and or acting local, it means that from an enforcement or SARS point of view, SARS determines the person that will attend that particular forum. Now, it could be that it's a person either from enforcement or a person from operations, and that is why we've just used the words either assist and or being the SARS point at that point in time. 2010, SARS, the 2010 impact is not just about the inflow of goods and people. It's also how are we going to apply tax policy upon the event itself and people who participate economically in this event. For that, senior manager position I know was advertised, I don't know if it's been filled, but there's a very comprehensive SARS 2010 strategy which addresses issue of the expected inflow of international passengers of about 750,000 just for that event over the 6 weeks of duration of the World Cup. So you know, very specifically, scanners that need to be in place, concerted effort by SAPS, SARS in joint operations and committees and meetings. Unfortunately, I do not have all the finer detail of our 2010 strategy, but I think the committee can rest assured that illegal substances, drugs, are one of the very high focuses. Hence, having the canine units being deployed, trained up, rolled out at airports. training, yes, the training that we receive, we have assistance from U.S. Homeland Security and Border Protection, the U.S. Customs Service. In fact, we have some of the people currently sitting with us developing standard operating procedures, assisting us with the training. We also have assistance from Canada Customs Service, and then our people have multidisciplinary interdepartmental joint training exercises where we share skills, capacity, and experience. And then some of our colleagues get the opportunity to have study tours where we can visit some other administrations and see how they do things. We come back, it's reviewed in our training strategies, and then rolled out as part of refresher training. Johan, will you talk to the text there?
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps if you'll allow me to just take a little bit of time and elaborate on what the Revenue Service calls the illicit economy strategy. I think parts of the points you raise could be explained within that context. The illicit economy strategy in the South African Revenue Service should be seen against the reality that crime in general is a huge problem to society and our economy. So where SARS has the statutory responsibility to collect revenue and to facilitate trade and to protect borders, and where we're trying to do so by incentivizing people to register and pay their taxes and declare what they bring into the country and pay the duties where necessary, and disincentivizing those that fail to do so by making it costly, by raising the risk of discovery, and applying punitive measures, and also to prevent opportunity for non-compliance. So making things easier, the electronic e-filing options, you have the equivalent in the customs domain, and so forth. It's against that backdrop that SARS acknowledges that it has a role to play in fighting this war on crime. So whereas SARS may not necessarily be a primary law enforcement agency from a statutory point of view, we are role players in different parts of the bigger plan. So the strategy that that was formulated last year makes this artificial split in the economy between those entities or businesses that are seemingly legitimate, so they're registered, they have tax numbers or registration numbers, they have postal addresses and so forth, and run a legitimate business on the face of it, but hide some crimes, so either people within those companies are involved in tax evasion or customs crimes, or alternatively those business entities or enterprises that from the word go is intended to be illicit. So that's the sort of artificial split that the Revenue Service makes in order to deploy its resources and its tactics. Now, the illicit economy strategy simply says we're trying to get people to move into the legitimate part of our economy. And again, we apply those principles of incentivizing, disincentivizing, and preventing opportunity. So within the Revenue Service, there are different components where the customs components by and large play the presenting opportunity and to some extent the disincentivizing role in the, if I can use your term, the input part, protecting the borders. We then have other components within SARS who are more of a reactive or investigative nature that comprise of financial investigators, auditors, criminal investigators, some legal people, debt collectors, that sort of grouping, who of whom we've dedicated 181 people to focus specifically on the illicit economy, as I've described it. And in the year, this financial year, that 181 people will grow to 270, and there's some plans to grow this capacity over time. They are specifically required to do exactly as you stated, to collectively with the conventional law enforcement agencies identify those people who for a very long time have been financially active in the illicit economy and those ones that have become very prosperous on the back of that. And one of the focus areas for this group concerns aspects of substances that could lead to abuse or dependency. Obviously illicit drugs, the garden variety drugs, then to some extent alcohol and tobacco, but the illicit part of those two focus areas. And they have been, and they are continuously in the process of looking into the retail part and trying to reconcile the assets acquired by those people against the taxes declared by those retailers, in inverted commas. And we've had some success in the piloting exercise. So you may recall that correctional services in Cape Town, when the Western Cape are the custodians of some tax evaders that we've convicted, who are well-known Mandrax dealers, and similarly in KwaZulu-Natal, we recently convicted a Mandrax dealer there, a very well-known person. And similarly there, I think about 4 months ago, there was a large consignment of tip that was seized in Rustenburg. So as we moving along, working together with the police service and the National Prosecuting Authority, this 181 people will do specifically, as you've stated, to begin to look at those known people. And you're right, we don't need too much intelligence insofar as who they are. We do need intelligence insofar as their assets and the flow of money. That's where the game becomes tricky. I don't know if I've answered to some extent your question regarding the tax gap.
Ms. Keller wants to say something, and I'll just allow a final round of very quick questions or follow-ups, whereafter we'll break for tea, and that would conclude our interaction with that. Ms. Keller?
Yes, I just wanted to again look at this from the perspective of, for instance, the Central Drug Authority and the role that it has to play within communities in relation to the very issue that you have raised. You would remember the famous investigation that we did in one of the treatment centers where actually the person who's running and managing this treatment center indicated to us actually that, me and my wife have been running this thing for years, and we've generated a profit of over 40 million or something to that effect. And you ask yourself how a person who is registered as an NPO a non-profit organization, and who's working on donations is able to generate that kind of revenue. And in our investigation, a recommendation was made that follow-up be made, because we were suspecting that the team that went there suspected that the person was actually using the facility as a front for something else. And those are the kinds of things that I'm saying at grassroots level, and people know within, you know, within these communities that these things happen, and they ask themselves questions in relation to, well, is this a profit-making organization? Is this paying a person that's subject to payment of tax? How much revenue is he generating for him to be able to buy a whole town? Because in the end, this person ended up buying a whole town in the Northern Cape. And these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about in terms of what would be expected, for instance, from SARS in terms of the Central Drug Authority to be able to assist with those kinds of areas and be able to then come back and give appropriate feedback to the Central Drug Authority on some of the things, on the things that we get on an ongoing basis from people at grassroots level, people who know who the dealers are, but who know and who know who they are, what the problems are in relation even to those that are purporting to be doing legitimate, you know, to running legitimate programs for addressing substance abuse and what have you. So all I'm saying, I'm just emphasizing your point that you're making.
I'm going to ask you a follow-up question in relation to what you've just said. In that particular case, was SARS brought on board? Is there a flowing relationship between SARS and, say, the CDA or the department, whoever was doing the actual investigation, such that you could get on-the-spot exchange of information of the nature that would enable such an investigation to be complete? Because, you see, it takes us back to that earlier question about sharing of information. To me, the CDA, and pardon my, I may come across as being insensitive, but it looks like some kind of a social club of this different government agencies or departments who occasionally come and drink coffee, and then they go back to their respective business activities. I don't see the CDA as the government integrated strategy to fight substance abuse. I don't feel it. Maybe other members feel it. I don't feel it. Even the presentation here tells me a lot more about what SARS is doing, which is good work, but it doesn't tell me much about how SARS is helping support this integrated response to substance abuse as constructed in the name, be it of the CDA or of this central master plan or this bill as a whole. Maybe I'm too much of a skeptic here, but I can't help feeling that way. So even this information, I don't know what kind of information gets shared at the level of the CDA, if at all, if there's any useful information that gets shared there. But what is clear is that there is a proliferation of retail, supply, distribution of drugs in communities, that these drugs are getting a lot more easier and cheaper to manufacture and to purchase, that more young people find it readily possible, easy, and affordable to access these drugs, that the drug dealers don't need to use compulsion, and they are above the law. They continue to operate in full view, you see, of everybody. That is the picture that we as politicians are getting on the ground. So I don't know if the story you have told me this morning at SAS makes me feel better. I don't know that. I can understand you have systems in place, which is good, but whether those systems going forward are going to result in us seeing, well, I don't know if anybody's collecting statistics that show what is the level of whether the rate of consumption is growing or going down, and what kind of drugs in statistically are becoming the more prominently used ones, and why, you know. I don't know if we have any intelligence capacity for any of that. So I must just say that it was a useful input, but I don't feel, you know, that it's making me feel confident about the future, that we're going to make a significant turnaround in the proliferation of this problem. And maybe in your concluding remarks you may want to allay my skepticism by saying something different to what you've said thus far. But I don't feel it. Maybe I'm naive. But are there any other members who want to make any last follow-ups before I ask us to conclude, before we go for tea? All right. Do you want to make any concluding remarks before we end the interaction with yourself?
Chair, thanks. If you will permit me, I'll give both my colleagues a chance to also perhaps, you want to have a last response to your comments. And then I will just conclude on behalf of SAS. Thanks.
Chairman, I think we're seriously noting the concerns that you're raising. Just one or two things that I wanted to perhaps highlight. One is the strategy, the illicit economy strategy that my friend or my colleague Johan has alluded to in terms of building capacity. I think one of the members here asked the question on how do we, you know, keep ourselves abreast with the trends and so forth. And I think these study groups that we've established, which they were not there before, you know, this is to ensure that SARS is well positioned to respond to the pressure, you know, that is actually growing. So my colleague has actually alluded to that. The plan and the presentation, as it appeared on the what call, could have, like you're saying, your major concern is that we seem to be focusing much on the first line of defense, which is the entry component. And we don't seem to be talking much, which is what you want. We don't seem to be saying much about, well, what is our involvement in the communities and so forth and going forward. In this very same presentation, Chairperson, there's a normal clearance that my colleague has alluded to, which is a normal customs clearance, trade facilitation and so forth. But there was another component that he alluded to, which is a post-clearance inspection, which allows if goods have by mistake slipped through the scanners, like you said, that we can be able to pick up because it's post-facto. So this implies that if the importers or some people brought in goods that we could not stop, because we're using a risk-based approach here, we don't stop every consignment that comes through. In terms of our own strategy here, in fact, I think 80%, if I'm not wrong, is it 20% or 80% of the goods that came through that were cleared through normal process, we should actually try and touch 20% of that, which is very, very, very complex. We're looking at the limitations in terms of resources. We're looking also at the political imperatives of this country, where we started, where we are today. I can rest assure you that if you look at SARS, where we were 10 years ago and where we are today, there's a hell of a lot of improvement, both in terms of numbers, both in terms of the systems that we're currently using. We're not saying that we are perfect. I think there's still a lot of things that we need to do. But again, the mandate of dealing with substance abuse is a very fragmented mandate. Hence, we have the committee, and you're saying, how do we integrate this thing and work together? So again, from SARS side, from the presentation and from what my colleague has actually said here, we are demonstrating, number one, the willingness to continue to integrate further and work with the rest of the other departments as well, so that we fight this. And we're also trying to show you in-house, what we have in-house, and, you know, to be able to assist or to be able to take full responsibility in terms of fighting this problem. The last thing that I wanted to just indicate is that I personally, for example, I run enforcement campaigns in SARS. The drug component is one of the areas. Now, I'm talking about business unusual here, campaigns. What we normally do is we would have various government departments, enforcement agencies and so forth coming together where we share information and discuss, and we look at a particular area. We even go to the detail of a geographical area. If we're saying the problem is in Marabastad, for an example, in Pretoria for that matter, there will be a campaign which has got both the enforcement leg and the education leg. We will try and reach out to schools or reach out to communities, and we talk about this thing. The issue is to what extent do we perhaps interact with the department that is responsible, the custodian of the whole thing. But I am rest assured that there has been a lot of activities, and we will continue. And I think this is very important that you provide us a type of feedback so that if there's room for us to improve, and you shouldn't be feeling bad about how you feel, I must say, that this can give us room or a chance or an opportunity to improve, we will be able to go and improve, and we're more than willing to do that.
Thanks, Chair. My understanding of the Prevention of and Treatment for Substance Abuse Bill deals with two parts, really, of substance abuse. The one is when people are dependent and they're abusing. How do we deal with that in society? In that respect, I don't believe SARS as a statutory organ can contribute greatly. In respect of the prevention of substances that lead to the abuse, I think SARS is a role player. I think the intent of getting all the different state organs in line to work off a master plan to deal with this in a more cooperative and a more directed way, pooling resources, using common knowledge and institutional memory is the only way to go forward. Whether one needs legislation to get the state organs to sit around the table and develop the master plan and give effect to it, personally, I don't know. I don't think we need to wait for legislation to do so. I think the
point I can tell you we do, because I've been a public servant before I became a politician, at least for 3 years, and one thing I've learned that the government officials understand very clearly is the language of the law. When something is in the law, very often they tend to understand, especially the kind of laws which have the possibility of aggrieved persons being able to approach a competent court and get the department at a cost to itself to comply. Those sorts of things actually make departments even make resources available for those things to happen.
That's a fair point.
And that's why we, as we're sitting here, we're looking at this bill and we're looking at how much more responsibilities we can load on you so that we satisfy that certain things you're going to do and not going to look at and say, well, it's not really a priority.
Sure.
So that's the answer to that.
I
but you can proceed from where you...
Okay. So in that respect, Chair, SARS participates as a norm with all the law enforcement agencies in the country in various forums. Some are legislative forums, so they, I suppose, came about by means of legislation, and others came about because of the urgency of particular matter. I can use the example of commercial crime. And there the partnership extends into the private sector too. So there are different private sector bodies. Yeah. And so for me, I think the question of ownership in respect of the part of the plan that will take the successes of now and look for the force multipliers of just now and make sure that all the participants play their role. I don't know. I don't understand this process well enough, and I'd be interested to hear more from the, let's call it the statutory body in the state that's responsible for the prevention of crime, and then by implication the crimes associated to substance abuse, and their view in respect of ownership of such a plan. So just a thought. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I think we're going to have to break for tea. Like I said in my opening remarks, we are concerned as this committee about the fact that apart from the clause that establishes the central power authority, the departments that constitute that authority and therefore also have to come up with their own mini drug master plans, the bill is very thin when it comes to establishing an integrated, interdepartmental strategy of responding to this. The reason we're saying that is that the CDA does not have executive powers. It's at best an advisory, I call it a social club of various departments or components of departments that have some interest in this problem to come and have coffee from time to time. It does not have executive powers. Ultimately, executive powers lie vested in the departments themselves. So the bill must talk to the departments individually. It must say to SARS, we think your responsibility is X insofar as supporting the strategy. Health, your responsibility is Y. Talk to health directly, not via the CDA, not via some advisory body, because a master drug master plan. It's a policy instrument. It's not really binding. It's a guide, if you like. We can't be satisfied as Parliament that we have adequately made our intentions clear insofar as what we expect departments to do unless we have said so in the legislation itself. So that is a long-winded response to your question and responding to your uncertainty about whether legislation does. At best, it is an expression of Parliament's intentions and expectations. But on that note, let's break for tea. Shall we proceed? Secretary, who's our next guest? Is Correctional Services next on the guillotine machine? All right.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Can I start?
I'm sure whilst the IT people are fixing the machines, we can proceed in the meantime.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Chair, I'm going to present on behalf of the Department of Correctional Services. My name is Choi Kutsia, and I hope the members do have the presentation there, because I'm going to take it from the hard copy. First of all, Chair, in terms of the outline of the presentation, I would like to do a short introduction and then just give an understanding of the corrections environment. Next to that, I would like to place the substance abuse within the corrections environment and then just also highlight the challenges that correctional services face in terms of substance abuse. And in particular, then move to some of the concerns or elements within this prevention of and treatment for substance abuse bill, and how that our correctional services is dealing with that, and just concluding remarks. Chair, it's no doubt that substance abuse is one of the major challenges facing not only South Africa but across the world. And I think we've heard from SARS already something in that regard. So hence, an effective and strategic attack on substance abuse requires a multi-agency involvement, including education, social and health services, as well as criminal justice agencies. I think, again, SARS has indicated that the opening of borders require international cooperation in dealing with substance abuse. And it is our position in the department that the prevention of and treatment for substance abuse bill provides a framework for early intervention, for treatment and reintegration of people who abuse or are dependent on or addicted to substances of abuse. A correctional services is at the end of the criminal justice process, and the perception is that the department only becomes involved at a very late stage. That perception, the department with its new direction would like to change, and the new direction is in particular based on two strategic pillars. That is, one, to promote corrections as a societal responsibility, and secondly, to develop correctional centers into centers of rehabilitation. So the presentation on substance abuse in correctional services includes, or should include, both staff as well as offenders. But for the purpose of this presentation, I will only focus on the offenders in our facilities. Understanding the environment, the corrections environment, Chair, I'd like to highlight four elements in that environment, and that is, one, the offender; two, the correctional center environment; and perhaps here I could already just request, and that is a request from the department, that the bill is still using the term prison. We have moved from that to correctional center. Thirdly, it's the correctional official, and fourth, the community. And it's imperative to contextualize the environment in which offenders and official functions when we talk about the substance or substance abuse bill then. Taking cognizance of the culture that exists inside the correctional center, if you are going to effectively manage the care and custody, development and control of offenders, and at the same time accommodate the needs of staff, that is within that context that we have scrutinized the bill. Correctional environment is also about good order and security, and then ensuring safety and security of staff, of offenders and external role players, and in particular ensuring a safe environment for interventions to take place. In terms of the offender, what we would like to highlight is that the offender, when entering correctional centers, they are stripped of support through embarrassment and dispossession because they have to submit to the processes aimed at managing their daily lives. And here we would like to refer to the what some sociologists call the pains of imprisonment, that is the loss of liberty, the deprivation of goods and services, deprivation of heterosexual relationships, deprivation of autonomy and deprivation of security. And we say in terms of the offender, Chair, that the judicial process officially labels individuals as criminals and defines them as being particular kinds of persons. And it is this label that largely overrides their status as parents, as neighbors, as friends, or as workers. Moving to the correctional center environment, it is a world where friends cannot be chosen, where physical conditions are painfully basic, and institutions, correctional institutions, are normally overcrowded. Separated from everything familiar, including social support and loved ones, and feeling of hopelessness, and being locked up into a cell and being entirely dependent on someone else opening that door has a very profound psychological impact. It's a matter of the stronger survive, it's a matter of manipulation. That is the context of the correctional center environment. With regard to the correctional official, it's important to note that we, in correctional services, do experience this dichotomy of custodial and treatment staff. And sometimes it's custodial versus treatment staff. Oh, I'm just trying to give you the context of corrections. And the separation sometimes even among treatment staff, because professionals or professional training is brought into a second.
I hope you'll elaborate what those concepts relate to as you proceed. I hope the treatment and custodial stuff, you'll elaborate that further as you proceed. All right.
Okay. Thank you. Chair, I'm also saying that even among your treatment staff, you have professional training brought into a secondary setting. You have people that are being trained as nurses or as teachers, but do not fulfill that profession within a hospital or within a school, but within a correctional setting. And that's why I say the training, the primary training, is now being put into a secondary setting. And in the past, the emphasis in correctional was placed on safe custody. The department has moved away, not moving away from safe custody, but moving to a position where the department would like to balance safe custody and rehabilitation of offenders or correcting the offending behavior. But we are also conscious of the fact that the rehabilitation process demands a multidisciplinary approach. Now, having given you the context of the correctional official and the dynamics within the staff component, this makes it a particular challenging area for the department, that rehabilitation demands a multidisciplinary approach. Currently, the emphasis in correctional services is placed on equipping correctional officials, that is your warders, to understand their role in the rehabilitation process. And the final component there, Chair, is the community. We have the view in correctional services that offenders are not from some distant planet, but that they are from communities in South Africa. And I think the issue of community involvement has been highlighted by SARS to a great extent. Sociologists normally identify the following socializing agents responsible for inculcating societal values and morals: the family as the basic social institution, the education, economy, religion, the justice system, civil society, sport and recreation. What we are saying with this is that communities thus have an important role to play in the development or rehabilitation of offenders. With that background, Chair, I would like then to go to substance abuse and the corrections environment. And research in South Africa has shown a high positive correlation between drug use and crime. And here I refer to the research done by the Medical Research Council and the Institute for Security Studies, that is the three metro arrest study in Gauteng, Cape Town and Durban. And that research has shown that offenders enter the correction system in different ways, and I only highlight two here. One, that is offenses directly drug-related, meaning the being in possession or trafficking or dealing. And secondly, offenses committed to finance a drug habit. These offenses like burglary, theft, robbery, many of them are related to feeding a drug habit. The Department of Correctional Services is entrusted with the responsibility of detaining offenders, supervising community correction sentences and parole in conditions that are consistent, that's right, that are consistent with human dignity. That conditions that are consistent with human dignity and correcting their offending behavior. I'm saying this responsibility, which is a statutory mandate of the department, needs to be carried out in a manner that is integrated and coordinated and which ultimately results in the attainment of best results in the most efficient and effective way. The White Paper on Corrections that was passed in Parliament in 2005 introduces a new chapter in the treatment of offenders. It has an emphasis on rehabilitation and saying that rehabilitation is at the center of all the activities or everything that we do within the department. And in realizing that, the department has developed what is called the offender rehabilitation path. And this path translates aspects of the white paper on corrections into practical actions. And these are the steps within that path, that is the admission phase, assessment. The assessment leads then to a correctional sentence plan, and it's within the context of that correctional sentence plan that we deal with the offender relating to the crime committed or factors that may have influenced the offenders in committing the crime. After the assessment, it's a placement in a housing unit or in cells, as we know that. And it is within that context that we have the interventions, and that intervention is based on a multidisciplinary approach. But having given the background of the challenges within the corrections environment in terms of staff, I'm again saying that that is the ideal situation, that you have this multidisciplinary approach, but it comes with the challenges. And the interventions then are monitored and evaluated, upon which placement could take place. We have a pre-release program then for the offender, and then placement out of the correctional center. And parallel to this process, we also deal with the admission of probationers. Those are the offenders that do not land in the correctional center, but do have a sentence, but have been placed straight from court into the community. And the department has also got responsibility in terms of dealing with the offenders that are placed in the community that didn't necessarily go through the correctional centers. So then this rehabilitation path ensures offenders' needs are addressed while at the same time protecting the needs of the public safety. In terms of interventions that the department has engaged in with regard to offenders that are in our facilities in terms of substance-related offenses, these are just some of the initiatives with regard to demand reduction, prevention, and treatment. One is the National Protection Plan and Escape Prevention Plan by the department. So we need to ensure that offenders do not escape from our facilities. And in terms of that, we have the National Protection and Escape Prevention Plan. The installation of advanced security equipment at correctional centers to improve access control. We have just concluded a first contract where at 66 correctional centers we have implemented or installed the biometric system, and that is all in terms of ensuring that people that are in our centers do not escape from the centers and that unauthorized people do not enter the centers. Also, contraband do not land into our centers. Also, another initiative is the utilizing the policy on the management of persons suffering from substance and alcohol abuse and addiction that has been developed by the Department of Health. It's just the interface with the Department of Health. We use that policy on the management of persons suffering from substance and alcohol abuse that's been developed by the Department of Health. Research into matters relating to substance abuse prioritized on the research agenda of the department. And then departmental efforts relating to addressing substance abuse consolidated in the mini drug master plan of the department. Further interventions are collaboration with NGOs, FBOs, and CBOs in delivering programs to address the need of offenders with regard to substance abuse. And here I can just mention, for example, the collaboration with CULISA, an NGO, CULISA Rehabilitation, the in-prison peer drug counseling program, SANCA, the Achenang, or Let's Work Together prison project, and much as I've said that in the bill, we still refer to the term prison. The names of the projects here reflect perhaps also the time that these NGOs are involved in the department. And perhaps those projects, we should also change the term in the names of those projects. The President's Award Program, that's a program based on focusing on youth that also are involved in substance abuse. Stop to Start, that is a correctional program addressing alcohol and substance abuse. It's an in-house developed program. The Pre-Release Substance Abuse Program covering substance abuse and relapse prevention, also in-house developed. And then the AA and CAD, Christelijke Alcoholistendienst, spiritual workers conducting Bible studies on dependencies. Those are some of the initiatives within the department and in conjunction with CBOs and other community-based organizations that we have engaged in. But coming to the challenges in terms of, and I'll start just in general with challenges the department face in terms of substance abuse within its facilities, we say that drug offenders will continue to pose many challenges for correctional authorities. And it is not easy to discern the most likely future trends and challenges, but some of them appear to be as follows. One, greater focus on programs specific to the needs of the individual offender through integrated offender management and careful assessment. Now, I've highlighted the offender rehabilitation path, and in that, there's already an effort to do exactly this. Drug-specific facilities in the form of specialist rehabilitation units which exist in correctional centers currently. There are not a lot of them, but there are correctional centers that have designated units where we deal with offenders who who suffers from substance abuse. Ensuring quality control in the delivery of programs, and then program accreditation as well as benchmarking and aftercare. Further challenges are close communication between corrections, education, social development and public health to ensure continuity of services necessary for ex-offenders to sustain positive behavior. So collaboration with those institutions in order to ensure that what has happened within the correctional centers in terms of treatment, that be taken further. And further within or after release. More detailed evaluations of the success or otherwise of different forms of treatment. There is also a need to recognize the needs of offenders from diverse cultural environments. And we feel very strongly about this following challenge: a management information system to be established and used within and across the criminal justice and treatment systems to ensure the appropriate delivery of services, the effective utilization of resources, and to collect data for evaluation and research. And I think Chair has mentioned earlier on about the sharing of information, and this is what we also say in terms of this management information system. Also, specific attention to male and female and youth and adult offenders' needs. That's the challenge within the department. Coming more closely to the bill, Chair, Section 4 of the Prevention of and Treatment for Substance Abuse Bill refers to development of and compliance to minimum norms and standards, which implies that the present drug units operating within centers in the Department of Correctional Services will have to apply for registration as public treatment centers. We put it as a statement here, but reason why we bring it here is perhaps to get guidance in terms of that. Is that the implication? Does that mean if the bill says that the bill makes provision for the establishment of private and public treatment centers, the question to correctional services is that currently we have designated units within our correctional centers. Does this mean that as a government department we need to register those units now as public treatment centers in order to comply with the minimum norms and standards that has been put within this bill? That is just, we're still dealing with that, but guidance in that respect would be appreciated.
My immediate reaction is that, yes. What would be a problem with that? The service that's rendered there is obviously treatment services. You see, there's been a culture in government that says if it's government, it's in-house, there's no need to regulate. And that's happened, I know, in the case of social development, with your children's homes, with your all kinds of things. And the theory is that the assumption is that government will maintain the highest standards of service, of compliance, etc., etc. Therefore, you only need to regulate the private sector. But the reality and experience tells us otherwise, that in fact, very often you find that the kind of abuse that people talk about does not happen out there. It happens in the very same facilities which are supposed to be the haven where children and others get protection. More the reason why you need to regulate them. I don't know what your reaction to that would be, but you can proceed with your contribution. I would say if there's ambiguity in the bill, I prefer that ambiguity be cleared and that the message is sent very clearly that you're going to be registered.
Thank you, Chair. Well, my suspicion is that within the context of the norms and standards, the particular challenge to the department would be with regard to staff, the lack of social workers within the department, lack of psychologists. We have 21 psychologists to serve an offender population of around about currently 114,000 sentence offenders. That is about 52,000 unsentenced offenders. I'm just saying, I think that is within the context of resources that we ask that. But the issue of registering as a public treatment center, the department will have to deal with that.
That's why we want to talk about it, because clearly what you're saying to us is that you're most unlikely to be able to comply once the relevant provisions are put in place. So we need to resolve that issue. As Parliament, we need to know what we're legislating and what the consequence of the legislation we're passing is going to be. Because an offender is going to come up and say that you're not compliant with the law, that in terms of this bill, these are the norms and standards that you must comply with, and that you are actually not complying. And that could have far-reaching implications. You know about the mandamus and other legal remedies citizens can use if a government department has a legal duty and does not fulfill that legal duty. But yeah, we'll see as we proceed. Feel free to continue.
Thank you, Chair. I think I've lost the signal again. But to continue, Chair, Section 28 stipulates that the Department of Health must provide detoxification services and health requirements to voluntary service users to a treatment center. Again, you'll see within the presentation there's just a question mark, the implication for DCS in the event of registration of public treatment centers in terms of this detoxification services. Again, an issue that the department needs to deal. The department hasn't come up with a plan yet in terms of how to deal with the implications of this bill. There's a team working on that. These were just the issues highlighted in terms of how the bill may affect the department. So that is another area, the Section 28, in terms of where the bill indicates that or stipulates that it's the Department of Health that needs to provide detoxification services and health requirements to voluntary service users to a treatment center. So how do we go about in correctional services when we are registered as a public treatment center? The cooperation between the Department of Health and the Department of Correctional Services, that will be the challenge, and this is being said from the experience with the current relationship with the Department of Health in terms of bringing services in to the Department of Correctional Services. So that is also another area that will pose a particular challenge to the department. If it is registered as or the units are registered as public treatment centers. Section 36, Chair, deals with temporary custody of persons pending inquiry or removal from treatment center. The implication for DCS in this instance is that persons placed in the care of the department, as in the case of, and we use the term G38, that is just a temporary warrant, needs to be referred expediently. And now for the department, it's just that the policy or procedures needs to be formulated in this regard. So again, it's just from the bill, the department recognizes that we don't have procedures in place in terms of temporary placement of substance abuse users. So we'll have to develop procedures in this regard coming from the bill, because this is, it's a stipulation within the bill, but it's got implications for the department in terms of how it operates. So procedures in that regard will have to be developed by the department. That's just an acknowledgement from the department in terms of...
But I missed that one.
It's section 36 that deals with temporary custody of persons pending inquiry or removal from a treatment center. And currently we don't have in the department procedures in that regard, so we will have to... We just acknowledged from this bill that we will have to develop procedures in this regard. The bill is clear in terms of if or the commissioner may or the minister may transfer an offender from a correctional centre to a public treatment centre, and there, in that case, like within the mental health care, the sentence will continue in that particular institution, because once removed for the period of treatment, the person will no longer be under the Correctional Services Act, but under that particular act, in this case, the substance abuse or the Prevention and Treatment for Substance Abuse Act, then will take care of the person whilst in that treatment center. But in the case of Section 36 of temporary custody with persons pending inquiry or removal from a treatment centre, we need to develop procedures in that regard. So, Chair, in conclusion, it's just that what we are saying is that correctional services focus in terms of addressing issues relating to substance abuse or substance use and abuse at all levels of prevention and treatment, from primary, those who do not use, to secondary, those who are using with negative consequences, to tertiary, those who require treatment. We cover that spectrum currently in terms of our intervention programs that we have and operations. The bill, however, focused our attention on some areas that we need to develop in. And we just say correctional services combines the focus on substance abuse as a health issue as well as an enforcement issue. With that, the presentation from Correctional Services, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
I like your approach that says, let's look at this bill and let's see what impact it's going to have on the way we currently do business. This is something that we're going to have to do differently because of the imperatives that arise out of this bill. All right. Even where you may express uncertainty of the extent to which that impact is going to be, but at least you're trying to make sure that you do not assume that because you're correctional services and this bill is primarily a social development bill, that it probably has nothing to do with you. Which is the kind of attitude we're trying to counter in this exercise, to say this bill is not just about what social development should be doing. And if the manner in which it's designed creates that impression that this is essentially a bill for social development, and that's it, then social development must start reflecting on the way they draft bills. Because my understanding is that this is a strategy of government as a whole to respond to this challenge. It's not for a particular department alone to deal with the challenge. Members, this is an opportunity to interact with the input from Correctional Services, Ms. Sample. I don't know if there are others who would want to. All right, let's start with you.
Thank you, Chair. Once again, another very interesting submission, and I can see that there are some challenges here for correctional services with regards to this bill. I think that your very last statement was perhaps for me, the most challenging, that correctional services combines the focus on substance abuse as a health issue as well as an enforcement issue. Because with your emphasis on rehabilitation, one tends to think that you are merely focusing on the criminal behavior, if I might call it that. I'm not sure if I'm getting my terminology right. But it seems like you also focus on rehabilitation as far as substance abuse is concerned. And, you know, I think that's very praiseworthy, Chair. But it's going to be, obviously, as far as this bill is concerned, the way that you do it is going to be the challenge, particularly around the aspect of your psychologists and the social workers. But I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. The focus of your presentation seems to be mainly on the rehabilitation aspect as far as substance abuse is concerned. But I think one of the concerns for this committee is actually the ease with which substances are obtainable within the correctional services facilities. And how are you addressing that? Because that for me is a huge problem, and you haven't really focused on that too much. And then the dichotomy between the custodial and the treatment staff, I think the chair alluded to that and asked you to elaborate further. So I'd like you to spell that out, please.
Chair, I think that was it. Ready?
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Going. All right. That seems to be the full suite of questions. I'm just wondering. My assumption is that this bill is the product of intersectoral collaboration. In any case, the CDA, which one assumes was central to the development of the bill, is constituted by a plethora of departments. Now, one would have assumed that the implications of this bill for departments would have been well known to all the participants on the CDA, and therefore the human resource, financial, and other implications of the bill, the added responsibilities and compliance requirements, would have all been sorted between the departments themselves before the bill went to cabinet, and that when we come here now, departments would already have even budgeted for the added obligations arising out of the bill. Maybe one should also ask the department, did you sit in some corner alone and started working on something that, from your own perspective, that did not take on board the concerns and the perspectives of the different departments? Maybe, Ms. Keller, you could just tell us a bit about that process of involving departments in this bill.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think the department did its best to consult with various stakeholders. I mean, you would see, for instance, in correctional services, some parts of correctional services are included in the bill. And this is the extent to which we received input from correctional services. And in addition to that, when the bill went to the clusters, it went to both the JCPS cluster as well as the social cluster, and I'm talking at the technical level, at the administrative level. Even there we were given input, and it went to the political cluster, we were given input as well. So whatever input is on the bill at the moment is based on the inputs that you receive from different government departments, and the costing also is in relation to what is currently contained in the bill. So we, unless the department would have, you know, communicated these challenges and what have you, in terms of costing, we would have included. But Chair, I don't think it's late. We could actually, as you said, the costing that we gave through to the portfolio committee is a preliminary costing based on the information that we had at hand, and it will be reviewed once we've, you know, the bill has been finalized.
Correctional service, if you want to respond to the questions.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, in terms of the question of the ease with which drugs are available within correctional centres, that is a concern to the department, hence the initiatives in terms of security equipment to prevent it, and not only drugs but other contraband from coming into. But you have the situation of those substances within the centres, and to a great extent, and right at the beginning of my presentation, I've said that I will concentrate on the offenders and not necessarily on the officials. We have, as a department, realized that to a great extent, officials are involved in sort of bypassing the system, and that is an area where the department is paying attention to. The dichotomy that exists, and hence, of given the context of corrections, we coming from a military approach to corrections, to a more human rights approach to corrections, and you still have a great number of correction officials coming from that era. So when I say the dichotomy that exists within the department, it's you have on the one hand warders, if I may call them warders, because we call them correctional officials now, but warders who saw their duty in the past as purely the safekeeping of offenders, ensure that they don't escape. And you have an era where the department brought in professionals like nurses, teachers, social workers, psychologists, a great number of them at a certain time. And you have this tension that exists between those that needs to make sure that offenders do not escape and those that come in for rehabilitation purposes. That is the dichotomy that I refer to. So we're working on getting correctional officials, first of all, perhaps to say that when you enter the Department of Correctional Services, be that a psychologist, a social worker, or a warder, you are a correctional official. And then you specialize in terms of security or social work or healthcare. Perhaps that would assist in bringing together a group of correctional officials that will focus on the offender as the main object, and not as my work is only to see that no one escaped from this facility. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. That concludes our interaction with correctional services. My time is after 12. It looks like we can still do one last input. I understand Home Affairs would be next in line. Probably we would have to come back for sports after lunch and deal with other business. But thank you very much for taking your time. All right, it's over to Home Affairs. Straight away.
Chairperson, thank you. I was slightly caught off guard because the Secretariat informed me that we would provide members copies and this will be manufactured during lunch. But with your indulgence and that of the members, the presentation can be presented on PowerPoint, if it so desires.
I think we'll have to proceed. Are copies currently being done, or what is the arrangement? The
arrangement was that it would be done during lunchtime. So we expected that I would present after lunch.
All right. Do members prefer? What about sports? Is sports here?
No.
Are they not here yet? What would members prefer? Would you prefer us to proceed without the written copies, and do the other two presentations after lunch, or should we proceed with home affairs now and get copies over lunch? Ms. Sample?
Chair, I think it would be a waste of time not to proceed, but it's inconvenient, but let's proceed.
All right. That's the general feeling? All right. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. The presentation we are making, and one should from the beginning just maybe highlight to the House that the engagements of Home Affairs and Earth was indicated in the document sent to the department for us to represent ourselves before the committee is to indicate our involvement in the criminal justice process, which at best reflects the treatment and the activities that we have with foreigners that's convicted of drug trafficking or any engagement in solicit drugs. And we are then primarily in the department responsible to ensure that people that went through the investigative prosecution and incarceration process is removed to their country of normal residence afterwards. What we want to highlight to the House, unfortunately part of it is out of scope, is that we have in the department within the National Immigration Service the Directorate of Inspectorate, the Chief Directorate of Inspectorate, deportations of which is one, is divided into two. Our sub-directed coordination, this is the division that primarily deals with all stakeholders prior to us even deporting a person. This is the division within the directorate that deals with the removal of people and the processing of documents. Holding facilities, as is commonly known in South Africa, is the one facility we currently manage. It's the Lindela facility in Krugersdorp, which also falls under the management of deportations. On the left-hand side, Chairperson, is a process that would go through, that the department or government would go through to deal with a person if a person has been convicted of a drug offense, be it use or trafficking. And deportation coordination would be responsible to ensure that the person is relisted. We call it the entry stop list. The deportation warrant is regularly issued to correctional services. We ensure that the transport of people at this point in time is done by correctional services, as our staff is not trained to escort or transport convicted foreigners. This service is currently provided by correctional services up to the point where the department takes the responsibility for a person that has been sanctioned in court. The next slide is trying to illustrate.
Does this person, sorry to interject, does this person get deported as a free man or woman or as somebody who is in custody? I would imagine the moment you drop them across the border, they'll just find their way back with their stuff. I mean, if you've picked up somebody who is not only having the offense of crossing illegally, but is in fact caught committing a crime, the first reaction wouldn't be to deport that person. Maybe you can just elaborate as you go along.
Okay. Maybe this will be more descriptive of the process we use in the detection of illegal foreigners in the illegal sense and also in the conviction when people are subject to criminal conviction within South Africa. At any point in time, South Africa detains between 2,000 and 5,000 foreigners daily. These detections happen at different stages and areas within South Africa, be it the police, be it border control. Our members from the Revenue SARS is also actively busy with the management of border lines, so we even would receive illegal border crosses from their environment. These individuals are documented at that point in time by the individual law enforcement agency.
the department is then responsible to ensure that all their documentation in the arrow showing down, centralizing all the information received by both ourselves. You would see that we indicate police, home affairs, correctional services there as well. And this information is all processed within the Department of Home Affairs. To determine the exact nationality of a person, we refer to it as the status determination within South Africa. So Chairperson, if a person is arrested and a person is an irregular migrant by virtue of him or her just crossing the border, that person doesn't fall into the category of a convicted foreigner. But be it the situation where a person is apprehended for the purposes of drug trafficking, inclusive of being an illegal foreigner, the first offense takes preference in terms of conviction. And that situation is usually managed by the South African Police Service in conjunction with all the other justice cluster departments in the prosecution process. So effectively what we're saying is we do not deport when other law enforcement agencies or departments across the board have specific interest to deal with a specific foreigner, be it legal or illegal. The department is at this point in time operating on a number of with a number of service providers. Being one of them is our facility managers. We are also in the process of outsourcing our transport requirements for the country. From the point of view is that we do not have the required transport modes and security required to transport criminals, women and children, and large amounts of male migrants within South Africa. So we've drafted specific specifications for transport and security requirements to cater for specific foreigners within South Africa, be it a mother and child. There would be specific transport for that specific group of people, be it a convicted foreigner being released on parole or after serving sentence, specific transport would be provided for those individuals. We have just finalized our information coordination system, and it's being rolled out to 8 new offices, and this, on the second rollout, it will be rolled out to more offices within South Africa. We have earmarked DCS as one of our service providers to have a system of that in some of their facilities. The purpose of this is to ensure that biometrics and all relevant information for identification is captured and stored for future use. We need to highlight also that this information is stored quite closely or in line with the HANES requirements, the national identification processes as is applied by the department. So it means that in future, if this person do arrive and for argument's sake, wants to apply for an ID unlawfully or a visa to enter the country, one might pick up that this person was convicted for a criminal offense, drug offense for that matter, and maybe refused a visa to enter South Africa or to remain in South Africa. We are actually actively at this point in time busy V-listing people, and then it results in a total new environment. The countries usually were not V-listed actively. So most foreign countries find South Africa's approach to V-list people not to enter South Africa quite strange, especially in today's age. But we are currently updating our visa and entry list system on a daily basis with information received from both the police and correctional services and or other migrants deported from the department. What is important for the statistics that we want to provide to the House is the rate of deportation that is currently taking place in South Africa. From the deportation facility in Krugersdorp, the last figure is unfortunately out. It's, for last year, we deported around about 72,000 people out of the Krugersdorp facility, which includes a large number of convicted foreigners, which we receive from DCS. And nationally, we have, for the year that just passed, removed 311,000 people. That is people that have been actively deported by different law enforcement agencies, and that information has been centralized within the Department of Home Affairs. So once again, it is at different levels that these deportations do take place, but the information is recorded and also included in our preparation and also planning for future events. Our current objective within Home Affairs for the department for deportations is to increase the effective
arrest, detention and deportation of foreigners that's illegal in South Africa. Maximizing the rate of arrests, minimizing detention periods. We would find it that it spells bad management if a person has served 10 years in correctional services and then comes to our environment and has to serve another 10 years or another 5 months. So we aim to speed up deportations from the point of release from correctional services and all other detention institutions within South Africa. The deportation rate, the audible trail of arrest, detention and deportations is something of concern. We have noted that releases from DCS sometimes comes that people are infected. They carry certain diseases which makes it difficult for us to determine whether the person's immediate deportation is viable, because the immediate deportation sometimes results in deaths of individuals which we were not informed of, that people might be infected with certain diseases or is carrying certain illnesses. So the provision of information within the system of deportation is quite important. As you can imagine, Chairperson, if a specific government requests information on their national prior to deportation, and there is no information being provided why this person has been in detention and is being deported, it sometimes leaves a bad taste in our mouths when we have to deal with different governments. Standardizing documentation requirements. This is throughout the justice process system, where a person is arrested, where a person would go to court, be sanctioned to correctional services, and then also lastly forwarded to the department for purposes of removal. Standardizing of standard transfer of deportees between towns. This is a daily activity where within the correctional services environment, police environment, and our own environment, members is transporting people in between towns for purposes of removal. We have made certain calls to the management of DCS to have foreigners, as far as possible, centralized to the Gauteng area if there is documentary requirements for purposes of deportation. Because it's quite difficult to ask a diplomat from a specific government to travel to Springbok to identify a national if that person is subject to parole or he might be released soon. Deportation routes, what we've also minimized on is the deportation of people via unmanaged routes. We have standardized which ports of entry and routes is used for people to be removed from South Africa. This entails resulting information management, more effective information management, to have specific areas of transit for deportations, and also to ensure that you don't have unwarranted deportations if a person is still subject to criminal conviction or other processes in South Africa. The latter part, and Chair, I will come back to certain anomalies and omissions that the bill currently have with regard to foreigners specifically, but the removal of property of individuals while in South Africa. Populating the national information system is quite important for us. We need to have point of reference of individuals that is currently within South Africa and in the correctional services that is currently being held there for conviction of criminal offences in DCS. Effective management of resources. As you might know, Chair, resources is scarce, and the effective management thereof is to ensure that wherever foreigners are housed within South Africa, these individuals are not kept in detention unnecessarily up to the point of removal. So we combine our forces as far as possible to ensure that when we transport, remove foreigners and even fly them out of South Africa, this is effectively done with a minimum impact on our finances. This is a process, if I just may have a slight more visible illustration. The receiving of people, we take relevant fingerprints, we have one-on-one engagements with people prior to their removal to ensure that their removal is subject to strict control. We also provide medical services if there is needs for foreigners to be screened for medical purposes, 24-hour security, and also for the removal. Chair, if you allow me, I just want on analyzing the bill, in conclusion, the bill is extremely silent on the treatment of foreigners as a part of our society, in specific reference to treatment and rights to treatment. As you might know, that foreigners have strict access to South Africa in terms of time periods. Specific foreigners may be required to apply.
We're told that about 90% of private centres, the lucrative ones in Cape Town, for example, are populated by foreigners. So that issue is very, very important. Who are we actually regulating if we're not covering that 90% in this bill? But yes, you're spot on.
And maybe just to say, Chair, the Act makes specific reference to a period that a person should be allowed to be admitted to such a facility. I think it's in Section 15.3 of the bill, as proposed. What makes it clear for us is if it's legislated, it means a person would have to apply on merit, and one possibly identify a concern that a 12-month permit, in terms of the bill, as being recommended, would then entitle a person.
Apparently, they just go to Namibia for a day, just to break the cycle, and then come back again, and then it splits, becomes a 12-year period that splits into periods of 6 months or 4 months at a time, something like that.
Yes. Chair, if I may, for us not having legislative framework for people to access our services or otherwise results in people using such means and ways to legalize themselves. With a bill such as this that gives a prescribed period for a person to be enrolled in such a program, this person can then request the department for a medical treatment permit for the legislative period to which he might be enrolled. With the absence of a framework, you have a situation where people are not given the opportunity to access these services properly. Saying that also, one should also look at Section 35 and 36, which makes it compulsory in terms of sentencing, where a foreigner in a criminal prosecution is sanctioned to such a service. How do we legalize that person during that period for which he was sanctioned to attend such a rehabilitation program? From our side, one say thank you for Section 15, 13, that would give guidance to people outside South Africa if wanting to apply to come to South Africa to be rehabilitated. They can now make provision of Section 15.3 indicate this is the mandatory period that may be allowed. And the department would have to look to accommodate such permits and applications. On the other hand, when a person is sanctioned by a court to go through a program, that one might be a bit difficult to document a person for that mandatory period as sanctioned by court. Outside of that, Chairperson,
what is the policy here? Are we marketing treatment tourism as a service to the international community? So is this more the business a business issue? And would Home Affairs, what would Home Affairs approach be? Because you have to decide whether you're going to license somebody to enter the country or not, looking at the economic benefits, amongst other things, to the country. What would be your approach? Well, you've already said there is no framework, but yeah, I just want to hear how you would approach it. Somebody's seeking a permit.
Well, that is essentially what it is, Chairperson. A person outside South Africa would request the government to give him approval to come to a center within South Africa. But there should be a basis to which he applies. The current situation with institutions of rehabilitation is they do not have specific legislation to which the department can say, but you do not qualify for this specific treatment in this environment. The bill makes it quite specific what the requirement of the institution is,
And if the institution then do not qualify, the department do not issue. So we have the facilitation role to, if on request, a person comes to South Africa and says, we want to go into a tertiary education environment or a treatment of environment of such as this, to look at the legal basis for this person to want to go there and whether or not the environment in which they are going into is regulated. So in the marketing of the permit, we will probably not do that, but ensure that where it's applied for, the application thereof, is in line with what the final act would recommend, and only in that regard.
Thanks, Chair. Chairperson, regarding the presentation that has just been presented, I hear the presenter talking, you know, saying as if this deportation is a very easy process, just from one place to another and then from another to another. Now, what they would like to know is, are there any challenges in between going from this point to that point and from this point to that point? That's number one. Two chapters, can the presenter maybe show me those numbers again, the years, 2000 and what, 2000, so that they can post what they wanted to. Yeah, yeah, just wait on that one also. Yeah, like that offender is sitting there. Is it just easy for them to keep him there, is what I'm asking, and then from another place, and then to that bus, and then to his destination, or her. Yeah, the other one, Papa. Of the years. Mm-hmm. I do not know what do these numbers indicate, Jefferson, as is the same, 300,000, 200, 1500, 500, according to the years. Does that mean it has decreased or it has increased according to the years? And then, Jefferson, the last one will be, what is the most important thing that perpetuates the department to deport somebody? Is it only because, can they maybe explain that? Let me not make examples. Can they maybe explain to say, we are now deporting Makumete because she's from where, according to 1, 2, 3, 4? Thank you.
What criteria inform your prioritization in terms of who you're going to deport, first, rather, or simply to deport? All right, Ms. Sample.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I think one of our greatest concerns around home affairs is not really the deportation issue, is the rapid amount of people who come back in. You know, the porous borders aspect. And I mean, it's all very well saying that you have the, I can't remember the term now, that enables you to tell whether a person, when they apply for a visa, etc., has had a violation before. But that's only if someone's trying to go around the legal route. I mean, most of the people who come in are actually illegal that come back. So what are we doing about that?
Mark Gomes, you want?
Can I follow myself up, Chairperson, so that when he must do one thing? Chairperson, can maybe the gentleman make a breakdown for us to say, is it mostly male, is it mostly female, or is it mostly the youth that gets that type of deportation of offenders, which is the most more number,
You know, I just want to, this currently, of course, our country is under seizure with this xenophobic, what shall we call it, wave, if you like. And for quite some time, there's been talks in the pubs and everywhere else, where people gather socially or interact, the link between illegal or immigrants, if that's the term, and crime generally, but more specifically the flushing our society with drugs, and there are certain countries which tend to be perceived as the biggest culprits. I won't mention their names. But do you as Home Affairs focus specifically into those issues? It relates partly to the issue of secondary crimes, as opposed to just the crime of entering illegally. Do you have a different strategy? All I heard from you is that you hand that aspect over to the law enforcement agencies to deal with. But my sense is that you have the first-hand contact with the situation. Because once you apprehend the person because they are here illegally, you have the first opportunity to interact with that person. And that's where you pick up their health data, whether they are involved in any other crimes, et cetera, and all the other social issues. Do you have any specific focus on the secondary aspect, or all you concern yourself is this person is here illegally, our task is to either deport or simply hand over to somebody else to deal with him?
Thank you, Chair. If you would allow me that, I'll begin with the honourable member's questions. The challenges in deportations, and for the purposes of this hearing, I left it out. It's huge. In the sense that South Africa's social composition in relation to our neighboring countries is quite close. And we usually in practice make a joke, Chairperson, in saying that for certain parts of the year, Limpopo is Zimbabwe and Gauteng is Limpopo. And then when it's holiday seasons, Gauteng becomes Gauteng, Limpopo becomes Limpopo, and Zimbabweans go back to Zimbabwe without us even knowing. So the challenges that we face in deportations is trying to determine whether people do have the right within South Africa, to reside within South Africa. And we have close engagements with governments to determine whether this people's identities is truly that of a foreign government or South African. And I can assure you it's not an easy task for a foreign government to indicate to us that a person who indicates that he's a South African is actually a Zimbabwean, Lesotho, and Mozambican, Namibian, or whatever other country in the world. So we have those challenges. People are arrested quite broadly, widely in South Africa. All corners of South Africa is currently being populated by foreigners, and arrests in that regard is being made. And the treatment of these people should, as far as possible, be in a humane fashion. Or otherwise, you do have situations where government becomes upset with South Africa in the treatment of their nationals. So this is a daily activity that should be managed and is a challenge. The other part is the management of women and children, especially children that is unaccompanied within South Africa. Be it that they have been forwarded to South Africa for medical reasons, educational reasons, but these children do find themselves in South Africa. We are forging quite close partnerships with social services in the use of their facilities to keep these children there until they can be positively identified. And we can liaise with the foreign government's social services for the return of these children. And also when it comes to people that need medical attention, because it has become quite clear that certain nationals do see South Africa as a haven for medical services. Balancing off the humanitarian aspects before you look at the law enforcement aspects. But ultimately getting to the point where you do enforce some kind of legislation to either legalize the person to stay within South Africa or return a person to his country of normal residence in the appropriate fashion. So these challenges are found daily within the deportation environment. Our detention rate for people within the deportation facility is between 7 and 14 days. So it means if you have arrived in our facility, within 7 days of your arrival, you would be removed. If we have all the processes in place and foreign governments have identified their nationals positively. But I should say that 99% of the individuals that arrive on our doorstep don't want to be deported. They would rather stay in South Africa. So that in itself poses a challenge to find who in getting them back. So these are all challenges that we face within the immigration environment and ways to deal with it.
And how do you determine the identity and origin if they will not disclose and possibly have thrown away all the documentation? I don't want you to release intelligence information in public. Your investigative methods, SARS would be very upset with me if I were to pressurize them to reveal their tools of trade. But it's just out of curiosity. It must be quite a challenge.
Chairperson, it's actually an international migration phenomenon. One of it is, in South Africa, we practice a process of integration. But internationally, it's known migrant cluster. They cluster even if you do want integration. Birds of a feather flock together principle. Because it is more safe and the environment is more conducive for greater social acceptance if you're in the company of your own people. Our identification processes for SADC nationals is quite difficult. We did an estimation at some point in time. 7 of our national languages is actively spoken in countries outside South Africa. And I'm not speaking about Botswana and Lesotho only. I'm speaking about Malawi, Tanzania. These are countries that speak Zulu. These people are at some level fluent in our languages. So it's extremely difficult when a person is fluent in your language to determine whether or not they are South Africans. Internationally also what was determined is a country to which you are not fluent in language is the country that you would not migrate to necessarily. So that's why countries like the UK, the US, has it quite difficult because English is the first language and everyone speaks it. So everyone in the world that can speak English would migrate there. In the SADC environment, you have Lesotho's that speak Sotho, Botswana that speak Setswana, Mozambicans that can speak Zulu, Zimbabweans that can speak Venda. These people can enter our society quite easily and be part of society without notice, because they speak our languages and engage with us on a cultural level as we would deal with each other. So these are quite difficult. Further afield, religion and also use of foreign languages and dialect is quite helpful in determining the French accent, the Portuguese accent, the phenomenal English accent in speaking South African languages. These are all the determining factors that one deals in determination. And then there's also clustering. You would not, as a Nigerian, so to speak, associate quite closely with the Ivorian. So these are the tricks of the trade that is applied within the immigration environment to determine specific nationalities. Once again, we don't convict a person on those things. We determine, to try and determine the status of individuals. If I can come...
Only members of parliament ask.
That's why I didn't respond.
Officials only answer.
On the matter of statistics, honourable member, in 1995, a decision was taken that we should look at improving the deportation rate within South Africa, not for purposes of removing people, but to bring a balance in terms of our entry and departure statistics, because there is a lot of people that do reside in South Africa after legal periods have lapsed. So we need to at least improve our deportation statistics. The statistics you see there is an increase since 2005. And our estimation is that it increased around about 18 to 25% per year. And that is the rate of deportations that we want to get. And maybe just to lay certain fears at rest, it's not only towards African nationals.
The last pillar there, whatever you call it, is shorter.
Yes. The reason for that is when this specific graph was finalized, the final statistics were not in calculated. It was done in March,
in the beginning of March 2008.
It's still going to push much higher.
It's 311,000 for last year, people that were deported.
Compared to how much the year before?
The previous year was 264,000. Slightly over, but 264 plus.
All right.
And why people are deported? Individuals from some foreign countries request the government of South Africa for entry and sojourn into the Republic. And those trips are monitored by times and also by condition. You can work in South Africa. You can study in South Africa. You can go to hospitals in South Africa. But there's conditions to that when a permit is issued to you. Now, once you violate those conditions where you are supposed to actually go to a hospital, but then you took up employment, that is a violation of the Act, and you're subject for removal. When you are allowed to enter the country for a specific period of time, and you overstay that period, then you are also subject for removal. And then there's Schedule 1 and 2 offenses in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, which directly translate into removal. Drug trafficking as one would result in the removal of a person, irrespective of what permit he had prior to his arrest. Poor borders. Just to respond to the situation with borders, Honourable Member, SARS is currently the chairperson of the PCOCC, the joint committee responsible to manage borders. One should acknowledge that the environment of the border is quite poor in terms of irregular crossings over the borderline. But at this point in time, I do not think the department is the appropriate person to respond, because we facilitate the movement through the border post. And the border security itself is something that we cannot speak to at this point in time, if you would accept. Thank you.
Who does?
That would be the specific committee which is tasked to look at the entire borderline, both land, sea, and air.
And which department is responsible for
SARS is chairing at this point in time the BCOCC.
So SARS is here, they can tell us more. They should have told us more this morning whilst we're still on this. All right. Members, it's 10 minutes into lunchtime now. Are there any last questions that follow-ups that people still want to ask? Department, yeah?
Thank you, Chair. I know, Chair, you indicated that as officials we may not ask questions, but I'm going to ask this question so that you can assist us in responding to the input from members of
government. We should make an exception to that rule with regard to this bill. We want to promote multi-sectoralism. So
now,
we want the department to hold each other accountable in front of us.
Okay.
All right.
Chair, on when the speaker was making a presentation, just towards the end of his speech, he made reference to the fact that the bill was silent on the treatment of foreigners. And I wanted to ask him if he were to look at clause 45 and ask us whether or not he thinks it is not sufficient. And if so, and maybe say to us, what does he propose, so that we can then go and look at it and try and incorporate that.
What's your understanding of what 45 does?
Well, my understanding, Chair, is that it makes provision for that admission of foreigners into the Republic for treatment at the treatment centers. And I wanted to find out whether or not he was saying it was silent on the treatment of foreigners.
Does it make any cross-reference to Home Affairs role in relation to the issuing of permits?
No, Chair. What it says the minister can enter into an agreement through the Foreign Affairs Department with any other foreign country for entry into the Republic by any service user for the purpose of treatment. Now, ordinarily, the understanding is that if you enter into such an agreement, you have to comply with the municipal laws of this country. If, for example, there are laws that regulate home affairs or any other government department, then you have to comply with those laws in entering into that agreement. But my point is...
It seems to me that you've taken it very far, because Home Affairs is saying we're currently issuing permits for people to undergo treatment. So the issue of international agreement seemed to be another level, which is not an immediate one. The immediate one is simply that people can enter South Africa via permits that Home Affairs issues purposes of treatment. And this bill seems to be talking about something totally different. I mean, international agreements take years to negotiate. I'm not sure if the Minister of Foreign Affairs is going to prioritize negotiating agreements with the over 200 countries of the world in relation to the nationals who may be wanting treatment. I think the immediate thing is to look at what is the role of Home Affairs in relation to this. But the question has been asked nevertheless. I'm not trying to answer for you. You must answer for yourself, and probably I'll have a follow-up question too.
Let me finish, I had another question.
Yes.
This other comment related to, I think I was referring to clause 15.3, and I couldn't quite get his point on what exactly was his problem on clause 15.3, because I thought that could actually assist us in trying to respond to the comments.
Is that all the questions? Ms. Keller?
Thank you. It makes provision that is section 45 to make provision for the period of admission to a facility, for instance, of a person from foreign country. That is my understanding then would be that. And I just want to see clarity in that regard, that if it says that a person who's admission in a treatment center for a period of not less than 1 year has been ordered by a competent court of that country to us, then it means that that person would have to obtain a temporary permit or whatever you call it from Home Affairs to be in the country for that period of time. Am I understanding it correctly? And whether you would, that is a clause that you would propose, or perhaps, you know, at maybe at a later stage, even if it's not now, you could actually assist us in terms of what it is that you want to see.
All right.
Thank you,
sir. Is there somebody else who wanted a floor? No. All right. Okay, can respond.
Thank you, Chair. In my response to that, I indicated that it's quite silent in the treatment of foreigners specifically, but it gives indication of periods to which a person may apply, but other conditions make it quite clear what is the receiving institution qualifies as well. But with regard to the specific foreign in terms of 30, where it indicates that it is prescribed that a person may not be admitted for a period, or should be admitted for a period of 12 months, in terms of if that sanction is given by a court outside South Africa, does that have direct bearing towards the government of South Africa to comply with such a ruling in a court outside South Africa? And if that ruling is given in South Africa to a person that is undocumented, are the department forced to document that person because a court ruling stipulates that he should undergo treatment? So if you look at the treatment of foreigners, the principle that is usually applied for the inclusivity of foreign nationals into specific social spheres is to ensure that one looks at what the current legislation is for specific periods of residency under the specific immigration acts. If I can make reference, you can go for a holiday in UK for 3 months, but you can also work for 3 months. But they make it quite specific. It's two different things. So you cannot go on a holiday permit, but because you can work for 3 months as well, you can now work as well. The permit is extremely specific. Now, if a person is illegal in South Africa and he's apprehended for drug trafficking, and during the process of prosecution, in terms of the act, if passed, it is indicated that you are subject to treatment as part of the ruling. Would the department be forced to document that person for that ruling? In our current interpretation, that person is subject for deportation after serving a sentence. Subject for deportation. And in the case where a ruling is outside South African territory, if the person is sanctioned to treatment, does it mean that person can use that specific judgment within the foreign court to
request access to South Africa to fulfill the purpose of the judgment. I think, Chair, that is where the international agreement comes to play. If there is such an agreement between South Africa and a foreign government to admit such people, if a foreign judicial system has requested that, those are the dynamics with regard to the international agreement. But in current play and application, it would be a little bit difficult on the one side, but would be possible on the other side to administer it, if the colleagues understand what I'm saying.
In fact, I think that the Act should not be actively promoting the entering into agreements with foreign government for the purposes of treaty, because it's as if you're actively promoting the service or the marketing international. You're promoting foreign trade in this kind of service, but rather that you acknowledge a situation where an international agreement has been entered into, that in that event, 1, 2, 3 is supposed to happen. So in a sense, the whole thrust of that clause seems to be problematic, if I understand your concern in context. That in fact, what we really need to be focusing on is to integrate Home Affairs policy around immigration with the objectives of this Act, so that there is synergy in the legislation and the way it approaches it. Can we propose that as we identify these gaps in the legislation, because like I said from the beginning, the purpose of this thing is to develop an integrated interdepartmental or interdisciplinary response to the challenge. So you're perfectly within your rights to identify gaps and shortcomings in the formulation as it stands, but you equally have a responsibility to go back and think of formulations that would adequately cure the defect, right? And come back with a proposal that we as a committee can look at, right? Because now we are in the process of drafting the law. If you don't use the opportunity, we're going to have stuff throttled down your throat, which you later make you choke, and you won't have the opportunity to blame us because you wouldn't have used the opportunity. All right? So that should be the approach with each department. When they identify an issue, let them look at it carefully and come with specific proposals. On that note, unless you have anything burning to say before we conclude.
Thank you.
You're comfortable.
Thank all you. Right.
Okay. So hopefully we'll be hearing more from you in the currency of our deliberations. That concludes today's this morning's business. We're resuming after lunch promptly at 2:00. It's already almost 1:30, I'm sure. Should I give you a reprieve or not? 2:00. No reprieve, the secretary says. She's the boss, you know. Where's the restaurant?
Pizza restaurant, ground floor.
Oh, I thought you were saying pizza restaurant. All right, it's 90 Plain Street, through the bridge. Everybody is invited for lunch, and we'll resume promptly at 2:00 with sports. All right, thank you very much.